Yes, this is KBOO 90.7. This is Tom Kramer being your guest host for Ava Lake and, by default, Julie Bernard. Today, by the way, that was Poet Laureate James Douglas Morrison, the great American poet. Today I'm thrilled to present a very rare appearance, and I was pleased when he agreed to go on. A rare appearance by the provocative, controversial, and brilliant art critic and Renaissance man, as it turns out, Richard Speer.
Oh, my.
And
what an introduction. Thank you.
It's great to have you on the air, finally.
It's great to be here.
I've seen you around for so long. You know, I was curious to find – actually, I don't know you that well. I've seen you around town, and I've been to, you know, big openings and stuff, and it was always the best-dressed guy, the kind of Carnaby Street guy with the – just this incredible sense of style, and it was Richard Speer, and I've always been curious to get to know you, and thank you for coming on.
Well, you are welcome. I've enjoyed writing about your work over the years.
Well,
and it was fun getting to know you when I profiled you for Art Limited. I loved the last show that you had at Laura Russo. Too.
Well, thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I wanted to point out one of the things I in particular love about your writing style, which I think makes it very unique, is I've described it to other people as extremely, razor-sharp precision kind of writing. In other words, this is, when I read your articles, this is a person that actually really looks at the work and doesn't just basically go by what other people are saying for him to look at. In other words, I think a lot of other writing in the past prior to especially you, D.K. Rowe, and Jeff Yahn, my three favorite writers, are that there was a sense that they were just reviewing shows based on what people were telling them what was good and how to look at it, whereas this is somebody who really is looking at the work. Now, I wanted to ask you
before, what I'm trying to do is to kind of replicate in the mind of the reader the emotional experience that I'm having looking at the art. So I try to open myself to being just bowled over by whatever is in front of me and then to use words in order to reconstruct or transliterate that experience so that the reader vicariously, if they haven't seen the show, can experience sort of sensually or kinesthetically what it is like to stand in the same room with this work. And if I can do that, as well as providing some context and hopefully informed opinion, then I feel like I've done my job.
Thank you. You know, I noticed what you just said was very interesting because I tend to agree with you that really great work, or work that turns me on also, is work that where I almost have a body reaction, not just a mind reaction. I'm almost altered physiologically by the experience of being around the work. In other words, the work affects me whether I want it to or not. It's just sort of like being in an old-growth forest or being at the beach on a beautiful day or something. There's no debate about it. It's obvious and incredible.
Well, it's I look at your work and I see a very transcendentalist sensibility. You know, you mentioned nature, and I you played Break On Through by the Doors. You know, I think your work is trying to break through the barriers and to raise the viewer to another level of consciousness.
Well, you know, I'd like to think that's one of the things I'm really interested in doing, and I think that having also gone to the library, thank you, I've also noticed you've written for some, you know, Art News and Art Limited, and also occasionally I'll thumb through Opera News and some of the classical publications. I go to the Central and go to their periodicals on the second floor.
Yeah, I've got an article about Puccini in this month's April edition of Opera News, and it's about how he uses the vocal line and also orchestration to beef up the characterization of his great heroines, such as Tosca, Turandot, Madama Butterfly, etc.
Right.
So that's in this month's edition. It's a fairly esoteric piece, you know. It's preaching to the choir of people who already are into opera. But it's fun to write for them because they just let you geek out. I mean, they let you be the opera geek. You know, you don't have to write for a general audience, and that's fun to do once in a while.
Right. I've heard opera is often referred to as the film of the 19th century. In other words, it encompasses all the other art forms: music, poetry, playwriting, blah, blah, blah.
Ballet sometimes,
dancing.
Symphonic music. Yeah, Richard Wagner called opera the Gesamtkunstwerk, you know, the total artwork, and built, you know, changed the way that we experience musical theater.
Right. Now, I want to also get into what are the, very quickly, it's a very broad-based question, but let's say I want to get more, I want to talk more about you, and what's it like to be you. You walk into a show, and what's, I know that's an impossible question to answer, but I'm trying to open something up here.
Yeah.
What's it like to be you and to walk into a gallery and to like to review a show in general? What's it like? How do you, what is it like a black and white thing? In other words, I really like this work or I really don't like this work, or is it probably more like a gray thing where I kind of like it, kind of don't? Or is it possible that you just have no reaction? I mean, what's it like?
Mostly, I don't ever not have any reaction at all.
Right.
I mean, I'm sort of blessed and cursed with being able to come up pretty soon with an opinion of what I think about something,
right.
Which is great when you write for Deadline. And when the ground I cover on a first Thursday or a first Friday is tremendous. It's just like a marathon. You know, first Thursday is my busiest day of the month.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all about going into a gallery, taking a lot of notes, making an impression. And it's so much fun. I mean, what a great job to be able to go to art shows, form an opinion of what you're looking at, turn that opinion into the written word, and then send it out to be either agreed with or not agreed with.
Well, how do you form an opinion? How is that done?
That's
what I'm trying to get at.
I think,
what makes you tick, you know? I mean, is it kind of your background in classical music? I did go on your website and read quite a bit about you to brush up on
you.
And I know that there's an incredibly wide range of influences. And what I'm fascinated by, I also think I'm this way, but I can read like Ayn Rand and Jack Kerouac, and I'm naming the people that have influenced you, and D.H. Lawrence and Hunter S. Thompson and Allen Ginsberg, and totally understand the relationship. Whereas other people, like if you say I like Ayn Rand, they'll say, well, that must mean you like Jeffrey Dahmer. Get out of here. You know, I mean, in other words, she's so demonized, and I don't want to get into Ayn Rand. We don't have time, but there are aspects to her that I really like, and people that don't like her usually haven't read her. And the same goes for just about any controversial figure like that.
Oh, she was a real polarizing influence. And like many people, I was first exposed to her when I was 16 and
right.
read The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. And for a while was very much under her sway. She
sure.
was a controversial figure, I mean, even after death. I am not, you know, involved in her philosophy, objectivism anymore, nor would anybody in that movement claim me as a member.
Right. We don't have to get into that, like I said.
Sure.
I want to get more into...
But I agree with you that this sort of diverse influences, the ability to reconcile various eclectic elements of existence, I think, is part of the background that enables a critic to form an opinion about something.
Right.
I think that probably half of the equation of most critics is just an idiosyncratic response. What do I like? What is my kind of art? What has my background and my studies, et cetera, accustomed me to really, really liking? The other part of the equation is a more dispassionate observation and evaluation of what is the artist's intent, and are they carrying that off in an effective way, even if it's not my particular cup of tea.
Right.
I think when you put those things in the blender, then something comes out, which is what we think of as an informed and well-supported opinion.
Right. I notice that you do you tend to favor work that has a tendency to alter the consciousness of the viewer, or at least have that potential. And then, you know, that's sort of what I deduce from what I gather from some of the people that you champion around here. And I know that you've written about Burning Man. You're a big proponent of individualism, that you do like the Beats and some of the things about the hippie movement, and
sure.
you're fascinated with Timothy Leary.
Yeah, you know, I was very interested in researching the counterculture movement of the 1960s for a nonfiction project, and also a novel that I'm working on right now. So, Generation X, which I belong to, mm-hmm. is a generation that has grown up in the long shadow of the 1960s. Most of us were either not alive during the 60s or we were prenatal,
right.
But yet we are judged against this great generation that, you know, went out to change the world. And here we are, Generation X. All we ever changed was the channel, basically.
Right.
They had Tim Leary, as making it, suggesting to everybody to tune in, turn on, drop out. We grew up with Nancy Reagan telling us to just say no to drugs.
Right.
You know,
right.
This is very vastly different generations.
Sort of mixed messages, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And the influence of that generation, the hippie generation, who was also the generation, of course, that championed civil rights, et cetera, has been pervasive. So how do we grow up in the aftermath of it? This was the basis of a lot of research that I did on the counterculture of the 60s.
Right.
Yeah.
I noticed that a lot of your life is, very verbal, right? You write for all these publications. Well, Lamet Week, by the way, everybody, is just sort of a part-time thing. This guy does all kinds of other writing projects and is also a novelist. And I just discovered you also do photography. So what I'm trying to get at is I know that you must have interests other than just verbal. And what are they, and how do you deal with coming down from the kind of overly wired state of always thinking verbally?
I like that question because it is true that I tend to get overdosed on words.
Right.
You know, my whole life is basically either having a conversation with people, interviewing people, talking about art, talking about opera, and then turning those impressions into the written word. And I personally love the chance to just get away from words.
So how do you do that?
If you mentioned photography, which is a nonverbal way of expressing myself, and I just consider it a hobby, but I do enjoy it very much. I enjoy the nonverbal act of composing.
Well, I hope you have a show sometime. I'd like to see more of them. I did. Everyone, I admit, he sent me some, I looked at them, and they look great.
I like to thank you. I like to take portraits of people, and I have a certain way that I see people consistently when I photograph them, and it's just I love doing that. So that's one thing. I also, I like to when my brain is so hyperactive in terms of writing, and when I do write, I'm very acclimated to the sound of the words, even though nobody's probably going to be reading this out loud. I judge each sentence's perfection against how does it sound in the mind's ear of the reader. It's a very kind of it's more from the oral tradition than from the tradition of a literary tradition. So I put, for example, when I look at any sentence, I'm judging would that clause. Would the sentence sound better if the clause were over here up front instead of back there? Or what if these words were juxtaposed? Or would the adjective that I'm looking for, should I pick one that has it as a trisyllabic word with the stress on the second syllable? And then I'll go through every conceivable word that would mean approximately the same thing until I find that perfect word that fits there. And then I begin to judge whether the sentence before or the sentence after, how does that middle sentence fit in the flow of that? So it's an extremely kind of analytical, maybe obsessive way to look at writing. And by the time it's done, I'm exhausted. And sometimes I'll just take a long hot bath in complete silence and complete darkness just to clear the mind. You know, back when used to have regular televisions and there was still static, sometimes I would turn on to the snow and just listen to the static and have the brain quiet down. I love to go into sensory deprivation tanks, of which we have a couple here in town, float tanks.
Right.
And I would recommend those. I think for anybody, drugs is another experience that is nonverbal. Sex is another experience that is nonverbal.
Right.
I think people who deal a lot in words and traffic in words for a living need to decompress from that.
Right, and I think that the whole thing about drugs and sex and all that is that we live in basically a puritanical culture, and I do think that both of those things can be good and bad. And mostly we get this sort of upbringing that, you know, sex is dirty and drugs are bad. But the fact is drugs can be also very good and open people's mind to new experiences. And therefore, I'd never be the kind to say, just say, no, it's ridiculous. They're, you know, they've been around for thousands of years. And many, you know, if you read Terence McKenna, I don't know if you have, that you have.
Terence McKenna of the psilocybin experiment.
Yeah, guy, right. Yeah, yeah. that basically that he believes that, you know, magic mushrooms are kind of the obelisk a la Stanley Kubrick's 2001, where they kind of were the very thing that basically brought man to the next level of evolution. And he believes that unless we do that very quickly now, we're going to destroy ourselves because we're basically apes, DNA to bash each other's brains in. We're combined with that with some kind of cosmic intervention. Those are the two components of human nature. And unless we kind of rewire our brains collectively very quickly, we're basically doomed.
I have read that paper, and I think it's a fascinating thesis that if you have a hominid, you know, back whatever 50,000 or a million years or more ago, and that creature is almost on the verge of conceptual thought and then eats a psychedelic plant on the savannas of Africa, would that weird trip inside that ape mind push that creature over into conceptual thought? Who knows? I guess we may never be able to prove it, but I think that for McKenna to have suggested that thesis is pretty daring and an original thought.
Right. Well, I really like, for example, R.D. Lang and some other radical thinkers of the 60s and Timothy Leary and Ram Dass and people like that. And even if you study filmmaking, you notice immediately how psychedelic drugs influence beneficially the film business. I mean, films became really incredible, in my opinion, commercial films especially, starting in about the mid-60s, running through maybe 1974 or whatever, movies like Bonnie and Clyde in 2001. And I think there's something about the lighting and the sense of atmosphere, and I think it did expand and help the collective consciousness of this society. And we feel that to this day. And one of my theories, I've never been to Burning Man. I know you have and written about it.
Been there twice.
Right, thank you. That Burning Man seems to be this kind of odd collision between capitalism, in other words, pre-hippie, pre-beat thinking, you know, making money, just pure capitalism, and a total kind of rainbow festival thing where everybody's running around naked. And the only thing that I can think of what may have been like that were like Grateful Dead shows had that vibe when you went a couple days before. The parking lots were absolutely incredible. It's sort of like India, you know, flashing rainbows and people really living life, and it wasn't just about money or
they do charge you to go to Burning Man,
right.
But I think that a lot of the people involved with that organization would say that they're, you know, they don't use that money to make a profit and become a capitalist pig or whatever.
Right.
They use it because they have to pay massive fees to the government agencies and the land in order to have the permits to put this on. And so I believe that all the money goes back into the festival itself.
Right.
And it is a non-commercial event in that there are only two things that you can buy at Burning Man from the official organization, and that is ice and coffee.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. And everything else is barter.
I wanted to get back to something we talked about earlier. You mentioned one of your primary influences recently has been Jack Kerouac, and you also said something that contradicted. Jack Kerouac was everybody who obviously wrote incredibly spontaneously, did not edit, did not stop. He took a bunch of Benzedrine and would sometimes write a novel in 48 hours on, you know, computer roll paper in Big Sur in Ferlinghetti's cabin in one case. On the road and stuff like that. Dharma bones are written that way. Now, you mentioned that you have almost a self-imposed micromanaging system in your writing. How do you square that kind of self-imposed control system on your emulation of people like Jack Kerouac?
Well, I mean, when I say that I like Kerouac, it's the same reason I like Walt Whitman and the same reason why I like Allen Ginsberg. It's this extremely poetic aspect to the writing,
right,
which I think is helpful in trying to describe anything in a way that enables the reader to experience a kind of rapture or rhapsodic epiphany or euphoria, which is hopefully what the experience of looking at art is about. So that's helpful to me. But I like the fact that you asked that, because I sort of consider myself two different people when I'm writing. I always say I'm a mediocre writer, but I'm a superb editor of the writing of the mediocre writer, Richard Speer. So my first drafts are always just crude and unformed, and I never censor anything in my first draft. It just comes out. And then when I go back, hopefully after an hour or two or a day, and I look at the first draft, generally I am appalled by the mediocrity of this writing. Now, some people are probably think the same of my finished draft. But when I go back to it, that is where I become the taskmaster perfectionist.
I get it.
Who is really turning every sentence around. So it's like wearing two different hats. It's like being two different personalities. The first is extremely brainstormy and non-judgmental, and the second is a real taskmaster.
It sounds like kind of like Jackson Pollock and Clement Greenberg, or one of those guys used to go up to, Pollock would throw his paint around, and then he'd have this buddy. It was either Harold Rosenberg or Clement Greenberg. I can't remember which one. But one of them would go up and actually tell him where to crop the paintings. And in other words, it's a little bit like what you're talking about, where editing everybody out there is probably as or more important than the actual product. We all know that. I mean, that's what you learn the more you do it. And I learned, in filmmaking, there's this like movie Seconds by John Frankenheimer. To make a long story short, there was this party scene in that movie, which is incredibly frightening and really scary. They showed the raw footage of that party. It was a very mediocre, like boring beatnik party, just kind of people getting drunk and running around naked and throwing themselves into hot tubs and everything. But the way he cut it, the way whoever edited it cut it, it was presented as a sort of nightmare. And then I realized, well, filmmaking is totally about editing and totally based on collage, how you put stuff together.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated with that.
Me too. And you look at some of the greatest writers that we think are born with a natural gift. Somebody like Scott Fitzgerald was draft after draft after draft after draft, and what comes out looking so effortless and mellifluous.
Gatsby, one of my favorite books. God, that's a great book.
So I think that the editing process, in no matter what our discipline is critical. But I also think that we shouldn't edit before we get something on paper. I think we should put it down. My algebra teacher in high school always used to say, get something on paper. It's easier to edit something when you've got something down there. I think too many people inhibit themselves before they put something on the canvas or the whatever the case is.
There's too much fear, in other words.
Right. And one thing I too want to say is that I think that artists and arts writers have a really beautiful symbiotic relationship. And why I'm in this is because I think artists are rock stars. I gravitate towards the visual arts. I love the artistic temperament. It's a privilege to be able to look at art and write about it. And let's face it, if nobody was making art, an art critic wouldn't have anything to write about. But then again, if there were no people writing about the work and contextualizing it, then I think it would be harder for artists to develop what they do. I think it's a very win-win situation.
They're sort of mutually dependent in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And also I think that I would argue that art criticism, good art writing, is in fact an art form. It's just another kind of art form. The ability to see, like Ways of Seeing by John Berger, classic book. He's an artist in his own right in terms of he's so good at art writing, or somebody like that, or this another guy like Julian Spalding, a lot of the British guys I tend to like better, because they have kind of a sense of neutrality about their art writing. And John Berger talks a lot about how we tend to look at things in terms of how valuable they are on a monetary level. He's kind of a Marxist, and I find his writing interesting. But anyway, getting back to it, how do you decide whether you like something or not? Let's ask another way. How do you decide if you don't like something? Like you walk into a gallery – That's a strange way of asking it, but
you know, mostly I experience it as a really visceral reaction that is immediate. And
what's the reaction? Is it like a feeling of forced or negativity, or is it the lack of what? What I mean, I'm fascinated by this too. I'm not asking it.
I do tend to gravitate towards art that has a real commitment to itself, that is, that has a thesis and that knows what the thesis is, and that advances it in a way without any apology. So that's the kind of work that I dig the most.
Right.
Now, that's not to say that I don't appreciate work that is more subtle. And I do think that I have had experiences where I was very neutral about work, and then the more I learned about the intent, the
right.
more that it resonated. But I do have to say that for the most part, the reaction I have at the beginning is bolstered by what I find out about the work subsequently.
Do you find that content is a glimpse? In other words, what you're saying is that you walk in and it's like a gut reaction, and that's usually accurate, like your body reaction?
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to get at, I remember like I went to a Francis Bacon show one time or a George Bazalet show, and it was just like blown out of my mind. I was in a great mood for weeks afterwards, and I realized even though the work may be violent or depressing, that doesn't mean that I have to be or whatever. Great work tends to, I think, uplift the viewer. Do you agree with that?
Well,
even if it's depressing work,
I think,
or not.
I like work that provokes a strong reaction, either positive or negative.
Right.
The worst thing is to go to a show and just be bored and
right.
to look around and then to leave without taking any notes because you just have no interest in it. That's the worst thing to me. So work that is even spectacularly aggressively bad to me is more interesting than a show that's middling.
I hear you. I think that the enemy of art seems to be in the middle rather than on the edges, you know, in a sense.
I agree. And I think that most of the artists that we look at now as great artists of the past or the present are people who are pushing the envelope and not afraid to go beyond.
Right. I mean, let's look at like late Beethoven string quartets. At the time, they were just, no one understood them at all. Or Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, riots broke out.
Yes.
Or, you know,
Beethoven is just so willful. You
right.
know? I mean, he's a brat. You know, he's with these rhythmic repetitions. It is extremely willful.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's great. That's what pushes human society forward.
I agree with that. And I think, again, getting back to one thing we talked about earlier on the show is the importance of individualism. I think greatness comes from a sense of individualism, not worrying about what others think, doing it anyway. What do you think about that?
I agree with that.
Well, great.
I think we should develop our personalities, or develop our interests, and then have the courage of our convictions and
right.
stand by that.
Well, I wish we could talk longer. Obviously, this has been a fascinating show. It seems like you've been on for like 1 minute only, which is a sign of a great show.
It's just flown by.
I knew it would. And we'll have you on again, I trust, for sure. And it's been an incredible pleasure having you on, finally.
Thank you.
And
I have enjoyed it a lot. You're always fascinating to talk to yourself.
Well, thank you.
And keep up the good work with you.
Hey, well,
with your art.
I'll try. God, it's so hard to keep it up. But thank you. This has been Tom Kramer, Kate Boo, Art Focus. We've been speaking with Richard Speer. Thank you.